It's The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega. Hope your holiday weekend was restful and free of labor. We've got a big show for you today, including important looks at different cases of police officers in the U.S. shooting people of color. But first, we want to take a look at what the Trump administration has done in the wake of recent shootings. Last week, the Trump administration directed the Office of Management and Budget to stop funding for racial sensitivity trainings in federal agencies, calling them, quote, divisive. President Trump also threatened over the weekend to cut off funding from California schools if they use the New York Times 1619 project, which reframes America's history with a focus on the consequences of slavery in their curriculum. Pulitzer Prize winner Nicole Hannah-Jones, the reporter who created the 1619 project, responded on Twitter, "Do those concerns about cancel culture and McCarthyism and censorship only apply to the left, or do they apply to the POTUS threatening to investigate schools for teaching American journalism? Silence is deafening here." Close quote. All this is happening after months of protests against racial injustice and police brutality, and many people disagree with how Trump has handled these tensions. At the height of these uprisings, data show two-thirds of Americans think Trump has made race relations even worse. Joining me today is Tim Wise, anti-racism educator and author of several books, including White Like Me and the forthcoming Dispatches from the Race War. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's take a look at this directive from the administration. What exactly does it do?
Well, it's sort of questionable as to what it really will do in practice. I'm not really sure to what extent anti-racism trainings had truly been ingrained and institutionalized in the federal governmental structure. So I think it's mostly a solution, quote unquote, in search of a problem. But at least in theory, what it does is it says that there can be no sort of trainings within the federal government that seek to address issues of systemic racism or, you know, white supremacy, racial inequality, if those trainings touch on any of the sort of, I guess, buzzwords and scare words that the administration likes to use, like white privilege. We can't talk about that. We can't talk about critical race theory, which they don't define, because my guess is they don't really know what that means. But essentially, they just don't want anti-racism training, because as you can tell, the larger analysis from this administration is, number one, racism isn't really a problem. And number two, any attempt to address it is just those awful black and brown folks and their white anarchist allies coming to take the America that you know and love. So it's all really political. I'm not sure how many trainings are really going to be shut down, but I think it's more to just give the suggestion that these radicals are coming to rewrite your history books and take down your statues and essentially overthrow the MAGA America that we all know and love. I mean, it's really just sort of politically cynical.
Yeah, I can honestly say I did not ever expect to see critical race theory trending on Twitter.
Right, right.
Buzzwords that have somehow, I guess, leapt out of the academic world into the racial discourse, interestingly enough.
You know, that's just it. My guess is if you were to ask Donald Trump, if you were to ask any of the people who are behind this directive to define critical race theory and were to say, by the way, if you get the answer wrong, you die. They would all be dead. There's no way that any of them have any idea what this term means. And yet they want to use it to scare Fox Nation and their base into believing that they're all these radicals who are coming to sort of overthrow the government, when really what's so fascinating about these trainings, I mean, I read about the one that they that had been ensconced, I guess, as of the, you know, killing of George Floyd. There'd been some trainings that were being done. I think maybe one was done at the Treasury Department or something. And it was really pretty benign stuff. I mean, it was just talking about how we're all, you know, conditioned in this culture to buy into certain stereotypes, and all of us are affected, not just white folks, other folks are as well, and that we have an obligation to try to get it right. Like, I don't know what's so radical about that. I was actually going to do a training with one particular government agency, two trainings with that same agency in July. Those were canceled. This is before this directive had even come out. Right. And all I was going to do was have a conversation about, you know, how white folks can be better allies and create, you know, work cultures that are more equitable. I don't know why that's so dangerous and so radical, but apparently it is.
But isn't basically this directive aimed at avoiding any sort of specific isolation of white people or white history? Isn't that part of the point?
Well, that's what they're saying, but I mean, that's just it. The training they actually, that Newsweek talks about in a piece they did this week, you know, didn't really single out white people. It said that we're all conditioned to buy into stereotypes and we all have an obligation to do better. My training was going to be looking at how white folks can be better allies, but by definition, the implication of that training is white folks are not inherently awful. We're not inherently racist. We're not irredeemable. We're actually capable of joining together in solidarity with folks of color to make institutions better. I mean, if anything, it seems a very sort of positive argument. You know, if I were going in there just to say, by the way, here's my white people are evil training, then I guess perhaps they would have a point, but that wasn't what it was. So, you know, I don't think they really examined any of this. They just decided, oh, you're talking about racism and you're talking about undoing racism. And that means you think there is racism. And if you say there's racism and Donald Trump is president, you're saying Donald Trump is racist. And therefore we have to shut all this down. I mean, that's the line of thinking here.
But given that these things happen at federal agencies, you probably have a wide swath of people in terms of political belief and background.
Sure.
Do you not get people who feel defensive in these situations and who may elevate those concerns to people who have political power and who just want to scrub the entire thing?
Oh, I'm sure that's what happened in the case of the trainings I was going to do. I mean, we literally were one day away from doing the first one in the beginning of July. And I actually got the link sent to me for the Zoom call or whatever it was, said, oh, here's your link for tomorrow. See you then. It'll be great, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, literally 5 minutes later, I get an email that says, by the way, this event has been canceled. And so I'm assuming that somebody had been, you know, maybe finally saw the memo that this was happening and then immediately, you know, jumped in and said, this has to stop. And the people who'd been arranging it were, you know, sort of career civil servants who were going to be there after this administration. They were there before this administration. They weren't political appointees, but Trump has put so many political cronies in these various agencies that when they see this stuff, yeah, they for political reasons, they run it up the flagpole to squash it because they don't want to talk about racism. Notice when they attack these trainings, it's not like they say, hey, we don't like your training. We have an alternative model that we think is better for addressing racism. They don't do that, right? They just say no training. So in other words, we're not debating over the specifics about how we undo racism. Those are legitimate debates that people even within the anti-racism community have. What they're saying is, oh, we're not having any of this talk because we don't think racism is a problem.
I didn't even know that these things happened at federal agencies. Do you have any sense of how long these have been going on?
Well, the one that Newsweek talked about and that the administration specifically targeted, I think is very new. Like that one, from my understanding, the way I read the story was that, you know, it happened or developed in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. I think that it was some of the analysis was spinning off of Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility. But I don't know if Robin had actually done any of these trainings with federal agencies or not. I've been doing this work for 30 years, and I would say in that 30 years, I've done maybe a half a dozen, I wouldn't even call them trainings, I would just say seminars mm-hmm. with various government agencies over that 30 years. But it's never been like a pattern of them. You know, it's I'll get asked to come in and speak to the Social Security Administration, or I'll get asked to speak to the Treasury Department or something. I mean, that's happened before. But I don't really think that there's been a deep-seated institutionalized practice of these trainings, whether a Democrat or a Republican was in office, to my knowledge.
Now, over the weekend, the president also threatened to cut off funding from schools in California if they use the New York Times 1619 project. Right. Do you know if it's possible to actually cut educational funding for this reason?
I don't think that they can legally dictate the terms of local curriculum. Remember, it's so funny to have right wingers doing this. These are the same people that when President Obama was pushing for Common Core, which wasn't a mandated set of curricular items, actually. It was just recommendations and suggestions and broad sort of categories of themes. The right lost its mind. They said, well, you know, education should be controlled locally. Local schools should determine what they teach. And now the same people are saying, oh, no, you can't talk about this, because they want to go back to the, you know, George Washington and the cherry tree fictional nonsense that they were taught as children, rather than actually address the history of the country, good, bad, and ugly. I don't think they have the authority to do it. But the fact that they're even trying just goes to show you that these are people who don't want to teach history accurately. They want to teach rah-rah patriotic nationalism as a substitute for actual history. This isn't about attacking political correctness. It's about attacking historical correctness. And once again, these aren't actual historians who are attacking the 1619 Project this way. There are historians who disagree with certain elements of the pieces in the project,
right,
but they're not disagreeing with the fundamental idea that racism, enslavement, and white supremacy were fundamental and elemental to the founding of the country. No one who's a real historian disputes that, but Donald Trump does, and his people do, because they would rather talk about, you know, again, George Washington and the cherry tree and Daniel Boone and the, you know, the whatever. I don't know.
All right. So aside from the fact that it's coming from the New York Times, you know, conservative boogeyman, what is it about the 1619 Project that has been made it such a big sort of rallying cry for conservatives?
Well, the one that's obvious, right, is that the whole premise of the project is that you can't understand America without understanding the fundamental embeddedness of white supremacy and enslavement in the founding of the country. But I want to suggest that the thing that really gets under their skin, which isn't talked about as much, even by those of us who love the project, is, you know, one of the key themes in the 1619 Project is black folks are the reason that we have whatever democracy we have. Like whatever moves we've actually made toward democracy and fulfilling the promises of the founders, which they had no intention of fulfilling, the only reason we have that is because of black people. Essentially, recasting black folks as true founding fathers, because whatever progress we've made, we really owe to them. That, I think, is what really bothers white folks, to believe that we ought to be considering Thurgood Marshall a founding father, and we ought to be considering John Lewis and C.T. Vivian and Rosa Parks and Ella Baker and those folks founding fathers just as much, if not more so, than the ones we claim to be that. I think that's what really bothers them. But that's an accurate understanding of history. If we really want to claim the greatness of the country, whatever greatness we have, we owe to the struggle of people who were left out of that promise at the beginning and who have fought like hell to make it real ever since.
Tim, we only have about 20 seconds left, but do you think this is going to actually have traction? I mean, even more than, say, the debate over Confederate statues?
Oh, it's all part of the same debate. I'm sure. Look, this is a strategy now. This is a culture war strategy. Everything the president does or says is about saying it's the traditional America versus these barbarians at the gates who are trying to take us, you know, to take everything that you know and love. But, you know, he's right. It is. It's a debate between those who want to go backward and those who want to go forward. And I happen to believe there are more people in this country who want to go forward. And that's where we're going to be headed, whether, you know, Donald Trump and his folks like it or not.
Tim Wise, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Tim Wise is an anti-racism educator and author. The Trump administration's handling of the 2020 census was already a contentious issue before the start of the pandemic. But a series of announcements from the administration over the summer have cast further doubt on the accuracy of the final count. At the end of April, the Census Bureau said they'd continue sending census workers door-to-door until the end of September. Door knocking was originally scheduled to end on July 31st, but was delayed due to the pandemic. Now, recent reporting by NPR reveals that the Census Bureau will stop knocking on doors in San Diego and other parts of the country on September 18th. Meanwhile, a lawsuit led by the National Urban League is attempting to extend the count deadline until the end of October. The lawsuit also takes issue with a presidential memo issued by President Trump calling for the exclusion of undocumented immigrants from the apportionment count of the census. Joining me today is Hansi Lo Wong, NPR national correspondent on the 2020 census. Hansi, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Arun.
All right, so between various kinds of fear-mongering meant to ostensibly discourage people from filling out their form, and now this, meaning the pandemic, this has been seen by many people as sort of the census apocalypse, just the worst. Is it actually?
Well, this is a very unusual situation for the census to be going through. It is clearly a mess right now, that there have been so many last-minute changes in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a historic hurricane season. These are all factors that are raising the risk of an inaccurate and incomplete headcount of every person living in the country, as the Constitution requires every 10 years. And the impact here, it's really hard to overstate it, because these are numbers that determine how political representation and federal funding are distributed to states and local communities for the next 10 years.
When you look at the numbers, the people who are actually responding state by state Do you see the worst fears of census advocates bearing out, or do you think it's not quite as bad as that?
It's really hard to say, as a member of the public, exactly how things are going. There are multiple indicators that the Census Bureau puts out. But the thing to keep in mind here is that Census Bureau research has shown that the most reliable, the more accurate way of collecting information for the census is collecting it from what they call self-responses. That is, households on their own fill out a form, whether that be this year online at my2020census.gov, or they call a toll-free number, or they mail back a paper form they've received in the mail. Those are the ways to get information that the Census Bureau says is more likely to be accurate. And then right now, about 4 in 10 households have not done that nationwide. And so the Census Bureau is relying on its door knockers to visit those households, to try to get those households counted. And there are numbers the Census Bureau is putting out showing how far along that work is going. But it's not clear whether that's being done solely through in-person interviews. It could be through what the Census Bureau calls proxy interviews, that is, relying on neighbors, building managers, to essentially be a proxy for folks who are not responding and collecting information that way, or if it's just interviews that are not very complete. And that all has implications on the data that ultimately is collected and ultimately is used and relied upon for so many things, including redrawing of voting districts.
Is it possible to tell how the pandemic is influencing the way this census is being conducted?
Well, the Census Bureau is already requiring its workers, those door knockers, to wear face masks. They are trained to conduct socially distanced interviews outside if possible, which is very hard in places like New York City, where there are a lot of apartment buildings, where a lot of the folks who have not responded are living in these apartment buildings. And so how to socially distance, that's a major challenge facing census workers. And the pandemic has already delayed so many operations for the 2020 census. And that is why originally the Trump administration, including President Trump, called for more time, not less, to conduct the census. That originally, because of the pandemic, the counting was supposed to continue through October 31st. That got moved up a month over the summer. I broke that story, the end of door knocking, September 30th. And now we are under this uncertainty because there are two federal lawsuits, one in California. We have this new temporary restraining order that essentially the judge is saying, Census Bureau, hit pause. We're going to further investigate what's going on here as part of the federal lawsuits. But in the meantime, this judge is saying, stop winding down what you already have wind down until a hearing is held on September 17th.
Okay, so is there any indication that the Trump administration is trying to influence the census for certain political gains?
I've been trying to figure that out. I think the thing what we do know is that there was a mysterious about face from the Trump administration. Again, in April, you have President Trump saying during a White House press conference that the Census Bureau essentially needed more time and that Congress should extend legal deadlines, and that you have the Trump administration officials asking Congress to do that, to push back reporting deadlines for the 2020 census, the first one of which is December 31st, 2020. That's when the first state population counts are from the 2020 census are due to the president. And then you have this mysterious about face. At the end of July, broke the story that door knocking was going to end earlier. The Census Bureau said we're going to try to meet that December 31st deadline. And the only thing that I've seen that has changed is this memo that President Trump has put out. Memo calling for unauthorized immigrants to be excluded, not from the census in general, but specifically from the census numbers that determine how many seats in Congress each day gets. That first set of census results that currently federal law says are due by December 31st, but you have top Census Bureau officials, career officials, saying since May that it is no longer possible to deliver those population counts, those state population counts, to the president by December 31st because of the pandemic.
There's really no precedent for this level of chaos in the census, is there?
This exact set of circumstances, no, but every census comes with its own set of unique challenges. And I think this one, where you have a pandemic going on, you have these ongoing lawsuits that are really disrupting things, as well as this really heated political climate where there's so much anti-immigrant rhetoric, as well as a high level of government distrust. These are these final weeks of the count where the Census Bureau is trying to convince these households that have not yet participated. This is a time where they make their last pitch, essentially, and try to do it through in-person visits. And there are so many factors against them right now.
Hansi Lo Wang is the NPR national correspondent on the 2020 census. Hansi, thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome, Arun.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
Last Thursday, seven police officers in Rochester, New York, were suspended over the killing of Daniel Prude. Prude, a black man, died of asphyxiation in March after officers put a hood over his head and pushed him down on the ground during what's being described as a psychotic episode.
Mr. Daniel Prude was failed by our police department, our mental health care system, our society, and he was failed by me.
That was Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren speaking at a press conference last week after the release of police body camera footage documenting the incident. Prude's death was ruled a homicide by the medical examiner's office. The video quickly spread across social media and has sparked calls for accountability, with widespread protests in the city of Rochester over the last few days. For more on this, let's turn to James Brown, a reporter for WXXI News in Rochester. James, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Arun.
For those who haven't been following this case, tell us a little about Daniel Prude and what happened to him back in March.
Well, Daniel Prude was new to Rochester. He was sort of cobbling his life together as we go in terms of the descriptions of him and his life. He had moved back to Rochester to be with his family. And that was just a few weeks prior to the incident. From what we do know, is that there were a series of troubling events to his family. Essentially, they were very concerned about his mental state. And in the end, he ended up running out of the house nude in late March. And if you know anything about Western New York, late March is pretty cold. Mm-hmm. We're talking probably 30-degree weather. Mm. And he was gone for hours and hours and hours. That led to the call to 911 to look for him. He went from Child Street, which is a few miles away from Jefferson Avenue, where the incident happened. So this man was naked running through the streets of Rochester, had to be for quite a while in order to get from Child Street to Jefferson. And that's where he encountered police. He claimed to have COVID. He was clearly, from descriptions and from the video itself, made various claims. He talked about, he asked for one of the officer's weapons. He asked for $70, I believe. He was kind of out of it. And that's where the incident in question happened.
And this happened 5 months ago. Why are people calling for justice now?
Well, if you take the city police and Mayor Lovely Warren at their word, Prude was, he was asphyxiated. He goes to the hospital. And when he dies, Mayor Lovely Warren was contacted by Chief LaRon Singletary. And Mayor Lovely Warren says that she was told that he OD'd. And there was a medical examiner report, which you mentioned earlier, where a homicide was declared. Mayor Warren says she was not told that it became a homicide at all. And according to now the state law, the state attorney general's office has to get involved at that point. And that's where this gets muddy. So there's couple ongoing investigations, both internally and externally. And our officials here in Rochester decided that they were not going to share this information with us.
The killing of Daniel Prude by police officers in Rochester has led to these widespread protests. And now the state attorney general, Letitia James, has gotten involved. What is she calling for?
She is calling for an impaneling of a grand jury immediately. She has also said that the city of Rochester could have made this information public sooner. So we've been hearing a lot from them for the last few days.
And the mayor of Rochester herself has also, I guess, apologized for not being more transparent about this. She said she found out in August, early August, about this the death, the killing of Daniel Prude. How has she accounted for her, I guess, lack of transparency to the public?
She called it a failure of her humanity, that she said that she relied on the city law department's interpretation of the attorney general's instructions. So she claims that she followed their lead on this one. So it was quite striking to hear her say personally that her choices in order failed Daniel Prude and his family.
There's also been an open rift between the mayor and the Rochester police chief, LaRon Singletary, correct?
Yes, it was very interesting. Over the weekend, late last week, the mayor said that essentially that LaRon and Rochester police were keeping information from her, that they did not inform her of the ME's report. And essentially, they did not give her all of the facts in the case. Therefore, she felt that she could not dutifully do her job in this case. And then over the weekend, they appeared together. And this was on Sunday. And she did an about-face. She said that she was fully confident that LaRon followed everything by the book, and that she was totally confident in him as police chief.
Well, that's interesting. So then you have the president of the police department union, Mike Mazzeo. He spoke at a press conference last week about his understanding of the case. And what was notable about that?
Well, a number of things. He claims that, A, one of the officers who was suspended was not on the scene at all. He also claimed that the officers on the scene followed by the book instructions from a state-mandated training that they took early this year, which muddies the case even further.
Certainly, this brings up a lot of issues that have been, perennial topics of conversation about how police are able or not able to handle mental health crises. How has the city of Rochester responded to the Prude family's intent to file a lawsuit?
A number of organizations that were already mobilized. I think that's really important to note here, that since George Floyd, there's been protest groups that have sprouted up throughout Rochester. And most of these folks are a part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And they've been working ongoing, holding weekly, if not biweekly, protests throughout Rochester. These folks were already mobilized. And then you add Daniel Prude's death to this situation. The focus has been, A, demands that the mayor resign. B, demands that LaRon Singletary resign. A new law that demands that all mental health calls be responded to by anyone but police. So there's been lots of talk of sort of rethinking how these calls are handled.
James Brown is a reporter for WXXI News in Rochester. James, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to the West Coast, where two recent police killings have also caused public outcries. Last week, Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies shot and killed 29-year-old Dijon Kizzee, a black man who was riding his bicycle when deputies stopped him for an alleged traffic violation, at which point Kizzee ran from the deputies. The sheriff's department says the deputy shot and killed Kizzy after catching up with him because he reached for a gun following a physical altercation between Kizzy and the officials. Lawyers for Kizzy's family say he was shot at 15 times as he was running away. Kizzy's killing comes just a few months after deputies from the LA County Sheriff's Department killed 18-year-old Andres Guardado, who was shot 5 times in the back. Here with me now is Ruben Vives, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for being here, Ruben.
Thanks for having me.
All right, there are some serious discrepancies between how Dijon Kizzy's family says he was killed and what the Sheriff's Department is saying. Has any of the video released of his killing shown what really happened?
Yes and no. The video that has been released, it was surveillance footage from a house which happened to capture the altercation and shooting that followed after that. It is not of the best quality, but it does show Dijon walking and deputies approaching him, and there's a scuffle, and both the deputy and Dijon fall, and shortly after that we see that the shooting took place. But it's really hard to see whether anything that the Sheriff's Department says validates anything they've been saying, but also it raises questions about what happened.
Right. According to one of your articles, the sheriff says Kizzy was, quote, riding a bicycle in violation of vehicle codes. The fact that he ended up dead makes that phrase especially Orwellian. Do you know what it even means?
We don't. And we've been trying to get that the answer to that question from the sheriff's department since this incident occurred. Their response has been, we have been unable to speak to the deputies, and so therefore we don't know what vehicle code violation he supposedly had violated. Right.
Why can't they speak to the deputies? What's going on with that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, they haven't spoken to the detectives, the homicide detectives who are going to be investigating the deputy-involved shooting, and so they have to go through them. But there really is no real reason why we should not be able to get these a response to these questions. They're very simple questions about, you know, asking, well, why did you stop him? And, you know, they've just been sort of stalling on responding. And so we've been constantly asking, not just us, but the media here on the West Coast have been inquiring about this vehicle code violation. What is it? And what prompted these deputies to just, you know, end up shooting him at the very end? You know, which is why there is this criticism of the department right now. Could have this been de-escalated? Did it really need to be reach that level of where the deputies needed to use excessive force? You know, was this code violation even a real reason why they were stopping Dijon Kizzy?
What should people outside of LA know about the neighborhood of Westmont where he was killed?
Well, Westmont's a very it's a neighborhood that has had a lot of trouble in the past. There's a lot of killings that happened there, and you know, there's a lot of there's a couple of police killings, just as you mentioned earlier. You know that shortly before Dijon Kizzy was killed, three months before that, an 18-year-old young man, Latino man, was also killed by deputies. I believe he was shot 17 times in that particular shooting. But this is a very, you know, it's a poor neighborhood. It's faces a lot of challenges economically and from a health-wide health standpoint.
And how has the community responded to this killing?
A lot of people are angry. They are obviously the killing of Dijon is to them, you know, this speaks to a broader issue of what's happening in the country of, you know, black people being, you know, killed by police. It's just they see him as another victim of police violence. And it's led to protests. It's led to calls for resignation of Sheriff Alex Villanueva, who they say has failed to hold his deputies accountable. There's other problems that are affecting the department. So this is all adds to sort of this frustration and distrust of the sheriff's department.
Right. And there's also separately been recent developments in the case of Andres Guardado, who was also killed. What's the latest there?
Yes. Well, most recently, there was a lawsuit filed against the deputies and the sheriff's department in the county as well for that particular shooting. Since then, the deputies have been named in this shooting. One of them is Miguel Vega. The other one is Christopher Hernandez. And what was interesting about this particular complaint is that it sort of tried to link these deputies to a reputed gang that operates out of Compton Station. They're known as the Executioners. And basically, it's just a group of deputies who just kind of, for camaraderie reasons, created this group. But they're not the only ones. There's like a series of them spread out throughout the station, and it's become a problem because to the families of the victims who've been killed by, you know, deputies, it's viewed as sort of a criminal gang organization, that there is bias behind what they do when they shoot and or when they perform their law enforcement duties. The complaint alleges a lot of things, but what's interesting is that it tries to link both deputies to a secret society that exists within the sheriff's department. We've learned since then that there are several groups operating within the sheriff's department, and critics allege these groups are violent and use intimidating tactics similar to street gangs. In fact, LA County has spent $55 million in settlements in which deputies were accused of using excessive force and belong to this secret society that's made up of these small groups scattered around the department, such as the executioners, the Vikings, the Bandidos, and that's sort of what's been laid out in that, that has come out as a result of that complaint.
Thank you. Ruben Vives is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much, Ruben.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanigopal. After being postponed for nearly 6 months because of the pandemic, this weekend, audiences were finally able to watch the live-action remake of Mulan for an extra $30 on Disney+. The film is based on a Chinese myth and stars a predominantly Chinese cast. And since it won't be getting a theatrical release in the US, Disney is counting on the film to be a massive hit in China when it premieres in theaters there this week. Since the first trailer premiered last year, though, Mulan has stirred up controversy in Hong Kong and abroad, with some saying the House of Mouse has become too subservient to the Chinese government. A call to boycott the film even began last year after its star Liu Yifei posted support for the Hong Kong police on a Chinese social media site platform as the police force continued to crack down on pro-democracy protesters. Joining me now is Frankie Wong, a freelance writer and illustrator who's written about this for Radii, an independent media platform focused on telling stories about China. Frankie, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so tell us how Disney and its brand is viewed in China. How much cultural significance does Disney hold there?
Disney is a hugely important brand in China, especially for people my age, which is called the post-80s generation. When we were growing up in the early 90s, there are few domestic, you know, animation that's equal in quality to Disney. So for a lot of us, we grew up on Disney IP, and it represents a part of carefree childhood that's very dear to us. So today, Disney has become like sort of synonymous with childhood. Every child knows Disney and its characters as well as American children.
And what is your experience and memory of the original Mulan, the animated one? What does it mean to you?
So I was actually already living in the U.S. by the time it came out, but it was very significant to me to be recognized, or rather to recognize myself in a Disney princess, which I never thought would happen. So it was very meaningful to me, even though at the same time, I think I was a little bit miffed by some of the details that were not quite right. It felt like a little bit careless by the creators, who I think could have done better homework on Chinese culture. But still, it was a movie that I really loved from my childhood.
And is this something that you find is kind of common with people of your generation?
I think the Asian Americans probably have much fonder memories of the animated Mulan, just because its representation and I think her struggle to please her family is something that resonates a lot with us. Not to say that it doesn't with children in China, but I think its reception was quite lukewarm when it was released. There are some cultural inauthenticities, and people wanted to see something a little bit different, I think.
Right, which is ostensibly what this Mulan, the live Mulan, was supposed to be, something different, I guess. But can you tell us what this star, Liu Yifei, made, the comments that she made on Chinese social media last year?
Well, so as you mentioned earlier, during the height of the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, there was increasing incidences of police brutality against protesters, much like what's happening here in the U.S. There were, you know, beatings, there were tear gas, rubber bullets, and she commented on Weibo, the Chinese microblogging platform, supporting the police. And basically, instead of being neutral or maybe avoiding the subject, she made it clear where she stood. And this is something I think quite unusual for a Disney star, because Disney tries really hard to stay apolitical and family friendly. And in the past, I know they've reprimanded young stars for more like inappropriate or indecent behavior. But under other circumstances, I would have expected Disney to reprimand her. But after she made that comment, Disney remained silent even until now.
And so the company remains silent. The cries on social media grow. Did the Chinese government get involved in any way?
No, but I think in a way their involvement can be seen in the way they don't do anything, if that makes sense. So on Chinese internet, the government's censorship is quite rampant. So the fact that they didn't amplify it necessarily, but it was clear that the government saying nothing is tacit approval.
And has this kind of seeped into the mainland populace? Are they aware of this and kind of rallying around her?
They are, and she has millions of followers on the platform. So when she made that statement, the film and Liu Yifei herself got a huge boost. People praised her for being a patriot, for supporting justice, because at the time, the response to the Hong Kong protests in mainland China was quite negative, or at least negative on the internet where posts were not censored. You can see a lot of people calling them thugs, calling them rioters. Again, very similar to what's happening domestically in the U.S. now. She was definitely praised for taking a political stand.
Now, Disney has been censored by the Chinese government in the past, correct?
Yes.
And how has it responded to those instances of censorship?
I mean, the short version is that they groveled to get back to the into the good graces of the Chinese government, because that market is just irresistible to them.
So how does Disney compare to other studios? Are they all groveling before the government?
I think Disney probably goes further to grovel than others, or perhaps it's because Disney has a much larger investment in the China market compared to other studios, because, you know, beyond the movie business, they also license their trademark to hundreds of local companies to, you know, sell everything from sneakers to lunchboxes, the makeup. And they also have the Shanghai Disney Resort as well as the Hong Kong Disney Park. So I think they just have a lot more at stake in terms of needing to stay on the good side of the government.
So aside from the comments made by Liu Yifei, there is another dimension to this Disney controversy, which has to do with the Uyghur population and Disney's sort of accommodations of security agencies that have been handling and really brutalizing them, correct?
Yeah, this is a dimension that came out shortly after the film was released on Disney Plus, when a few sharp-eyed viewers noticed that they were thanking these different government agencies and publicity departments based in Xinjiang, which is where, according to estimations, like a million people are in concentration camps. And there's confirmation that director Nicky Carroll scouted location in Xinjiang, and they've shot some of the scenes there as well. And I think as of now, Disney didn't give any comments when different publications reached out to them. And this is exactly what happened when Liu Yifei made her pro-police comments last year. I think Disney keeps trying to just let the churn of the media cycle take this away. But I have a feeling they won't be able to, you know, wait this one out, just because we're coming up on the election, and being tough on China is something that politicians are sort of more interested in right now. I think it's very possible that some political leaders, maybe even Joe Biden or Donald Trump, is going to demand that Disney take a stand on the Xinjiang controversy.
Frankie Wong is a freelance writer and illustrator. Frankie, thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. To listen back to anything, go to thetakeaway.org. And as always, if you have any thoughts or would like to share your comments with us, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll talk to you tomorrow.